From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Fear and uncertainty make people do questionable things. Take the 1920s in this country. The journalist Adam Cohen says middle and upper class Americans felt threatened. Urbanization was changing everything and immigrants were streaming in. This, he says, was the driving force behind eugenics. It was the idea of using the newly discovered science of heredity to perfect humanity. So these sterilization laws were passed in states around the country. 60 to 70,000 people were sterilized, and many of the victims were like Carrie Buck, a teenager from Virginia who was considered feeble-minded, even though she was perfectly normal mentally and physically. Cohen builds the story of eugenics around Carrie Buck, and he'll join us today. His book is called Imbeciles. Join us after the news. This week on Video West, University of Utah biologist David Carrier explains the theory he tested on cadaver arms. The idea has caused a bit of a stir in the scientific community. Carrier believes the human hand evolved the way it did, not only to be delicate and to handle tools, but also to be used as a weapon to throw a punch. Go see him explain it at videowest.org. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. This idea of eugenics, that you can breed out the genetically unfit by keeping them from reproducing, sounds creepy and dated today, but the journalist Adam Cohen says you can trace its origins to legitimate science, to Darwin and his discoveries about natural selection. In fact, it was Darwin's half-cousin who created the eugenics theory. In the 1920s, Cohen says lots of Americans worried about the immigrants streaming in, that they would dilute the American bloodline and bring down the country, maybe even the human race. Cohen has written a book about the American eugenics movement, and he says it attracted different people for different reasons. Progressives thought it was a way to use science to reform society. Conservatives, he says, saw it as a confirmation of their idea that the races were different. The practical result of this idea was laws passed throughout the country that would sterilize people with hereditary defects. It meant criminality, it meant dependency, that just meant the poor. For some reason, it meant epilepsy, and you could be forcibly sterilized for being feeble-minded. And that designation took in a lot of categories, like mental illness and sexually permissive women. 60 to 70,000 people were sterilized in this country during this period. And Adam Cohen builds his book around one of the stories, in particular, the story of Carrie Buck, a Virginia teenager who gave birth out of wedlock. And even though she was physically and mentally normal, some very powerful people managed to fit her into the feeble-minded category. Her case made it to the Supreme Court. Adam Cohen is with us today to talk about his book. It's called Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. Adam Cohen is a journalist and a lawyer. He was on the New York Times editorial board and was a senior writer for Time magazine. He also lectured at Yale Law School. He's joining us today from NPR in New York. And Adam Cohen, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
You say in the book that this story is not very well remembered today. I want to ask you why that is. But first, let me ask you, how is it then that you found the story? When did this come to your attention?
Well, I first heard about it in law school, but interestingly, when I was at Harvard Law School, it was not taught in my constitutional law class. But we knew that there was this phrase that three generations of imbeciles are enough. We had heard that, and we knew that the great Oliver Wendell Holmes, who was a very revered figure at Harvard Law School where he once taught and is thought of as being one of the greatest justices in history, we knew that he had written that. So it really lodged in my mind as to what was going on with that strange phrase and the strange case.
It could have been just a legal history that you wrote about, but you really, I guess you wanted to really key on one story in particular. And Carrie Buck's story, which we'll get to, is a pretty profound and sad kind of tragic story. But that's how you tell the story. You sort of build it around her circumstance, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, it is important that it's a Supreme Court case. I mean, there are definitely are histories to be written about the eugenics movement in America. There have been and there will be more. But I thought it was very significant that the United States Supreme Court, which was established by the founders to be really our bastion of justice, the one body sort of removed from politics that would do the right thing, that they got it so wrong that 8-1 they said she should be sterilized, Carrie Buck, and also that they wildly endorsed eugenics. So I thought that fact that this important branch of our government went so off the rails was itself very significant.
What do you think the story is about, just broadly? It seems like you've settled on power, that this is kind of about power.
Yeah, I think it is. And as you alluded to at the start, this was an interesting time, the 1920s. We think of it now from the movies as a time of flappers and happy parties and all that, but it really wasn't. It was a time when the country was going through a lot of changes and soul searching. In particular, there had been decades of record level immigration. Industrialization was moving people off of the farms into the cities, which were becoming very crowded and difficult places. So it was really a time of enormous change. And I think it's right that a big part of what motivated the eugenics movement in America was the middle classes and the upper classes trying to exert some control, exert some power over a situation that was really out of their control.
Mm. You mentioned the Code of Hammurabi early on in the book, this legal, ancient legal concept or idea anyway, that the law is supposed to keep the mighty from exploiting the weak. This is a perfect example of that, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason I cite that in the introduction is it's such an ancient principle of justice, right? It was discovered by French archaeologists, you know, in the deserts of Iraq in 1902, and it's 3,500 years old. But even back then in the Babylonian era, when they were writing their laws, they knew that that was the animating principle. The reason we have law is to protect the weak from the strong. And then if that is the principle, if that's sort of the human principle of justice, how could we have gotten it so wrong in America in the 1920s and then on the Supreme Court?
You talked about the sort of the driving forces that were at play, these record levels of immigration changing the demographics of the country. And so the upper and middle classes don't know what to do with that. They're uncertain. They feel afraid, I guess. But in some ways, when you look at it, there's this inclination to say this is just base racism. Is it fair to say that, or is it more – obviously, it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, I mean, certainly racism was part of it, but you know, it is interesting that Carrie Buck was white,
right?
Like many people think that the person at the center of this, a poor woman from Virginia in 1924 who they want to sterilize, is going to be a black woman, but it was a white woman. So yes, race was a part of it, but in an interesting way, which is that when Virginia passed its eugenic sterilization law in 1924, the same day the legislature passed it, it passed a racial purity act to punish even more greatly relations between the white and black races. So why did these two things happen at the same time? Because what the eugenicists wanted in the South in that era was to uplift the white race. They didn't care about the black race. They had written it off. They didn't think it was going to, you know, do much for humanity. So their concern was separating out the black race so it wouldn't taint the white race, and then going after people like Carrie Buck, who are the lower classes economically and socially and in education, get those lower class whites, so to speak, not to reproduce. And then their goal was to produce this wonderful white race. So racism was embedded in it, but was really about uplifting, you know, these people's very warped view of what the best of humanity was.
Yeah. So much of this is about class. When you talk about Carrie Buck and her mother, which we'll get to a little bit later, but you say that sort of the trajectory for the lower classes in the 1920s, it was headed downward, and this was about class too.
That's right. And her own family, her family's own trajectory was downward. But that's right. I mean, there was really a panic in the country about the feeble-minded, but there was also a panic about the lower classes. There was a feeling that there were all these poor, particularly rural people in places like Virginia who were living in their own little enclaves and reproducing and producing, you know, criminals and defective people. And there was a whole field of anthropology where professors would go out and visit these people and try to figure out what was wrong with them. So there was a real concern that, you know, that the lower classes were bad, they were going downward, they were reproducing too rapidly, and that something had to be done.
Where does environment, the idea of, you know, in the nature-nurture argument, where does the question of environment – when does it start to emerge? Because it seems like the idea of environment, not it wasn't entirely discounted, but didn't seem like it was taken into account. Certainly at this part of the process of eugenics.
Yeah, it's a very interesting question. There was a famous family, the Jukes, who were studied. It's a pseudonym, but they were a lower class family that the people who discovered them and interviewed the many descendants of the Jukes family decided that they had a high percentage of criminality in particular, but feeble-mindedness and prostitution and other problems. It's very interesting that the man who discovered the Jukes family originally was an environmentalist. He believed that their problem was that they were poor and living in poor conditions without enough education. And his solution, he was really a prison reformer, was to try to bring social programs to bear. But then in the eugenics era, people go back and revisit the Jukes case, and suddenly it's all about genes. And the very family that he thought was a testament to environmental problems, they decided was genetically inferior. And really, in the 10s and in particular 20s, this environmental idea gets pushed to the side, and people are really using the newly discovered genetic theories to say, no, this is stuff that runs in families, and we have to breed it out.
You see, it emerges in England by the followers of Darwin. And I mentioned Francis Galton, Darwin's half-cousin. He's really the one who's seems to get the ball rolling in terms of the theory. Talk about the origins of how Darwin's ideas of natural selection somehow mutate into eugenics.
Yeah, Darwin was someone who really just thought he was observing the natural order, observing scientifically, and his books were written in that vein. His half-cousin, Francis Galton, was the one who said, well, if this is what nature does, if nature is about survival of the fittest, as my half-cousin Charles says, why not take nature in hand? Why not have human beings really plan this? So what nature does, as he thought, you know, chaotically and violently, humanity could do in a scientific and reasonable way by choosing who marries and who reproduces and who doesn't. So it was a natural extension of Darwin, although Darwin himself never endorsed eugenics and did not agree with these views. But right, there were plenty of others who did.
Beyond the basic understanding of genetics, what was the, if you can put it this way, the actual legitimate science that sort of undergirds eugenics? I mean, was there any sort of legitimate scientific understanding that sort of goes off the rails but is the beginning of the thinking?
Yes, there was. This was an era, the beginning of the 20th century, when the discoveries of Gregor Mendel, the Bohemian monk who did experiments with pea plants, his discoveries about genetic inheritance were really just being discovered and embraced. So people began to realize that there was such a thing as a gene, and that the genes did pass on from generation to generation, carrying certain traits. So you know, Mendel was able to show that certain shapes of plants and sizes and so forth were genetically based. And there were ways in which this was seen to extend into human beings. So blood type and hair color, eye color, things like that were genetic. The real, as you say, going off the rails was when they began to say, oh, well, if you can inherit your eye color in a genetic pattern, that must also mean that you can inherit being a no good, poor, will never work a day in his life kind of person. And that was where they tried to extend it.
Let's talk about how they decided who was defective. I understand it's hard to justify, but you get where they're coming from in terms of criminality and alcoholism and poverty, even though they're incredibly one-dimensional and kind of reductive conclusions. But feeble-minded, what does feeble-minded really mean? Because you mentioned it didn't take much evidence to have someone declared feeble-minded and locked up in the 20s.
Right. It was such a malleable category. And certainly part of it was intelligence and mental acuity, ability to do well on intelligence exams and so forth. But other parts of it were just anything that the people in power, the judges, the social workers mm-hmm. thought was undesirable. So women were literally labeled feeble-minded for seeming to be too interested in sex. Yeah. People could be labeled feeble-minded just for, you know, for misbehaving. You know, a child who passed too many notes in class, that would be the sort of thing that could be part of a case of feeble-mindedness. So it became really a big grab bag category that they could stuff in all the characteristics they didn't like.
There were, I think it was Laughlin who comes up with Harry Laughlin, whom we'll get to here in a second. Was it Laughlin who comes up with the 10 defective classes?
Yeah, he does. And he's a big theorist in the eugenics yeah. area. He's the head of the Eugenics Record Office. And he was very influential in choosing the categories. And right. he actually wrote a model statute that was used by many states when they drew up their own laws. And there, you know, were many, you know, I would say kind of crazy categories that he put in his model statute, including things like the indolent or, you know, people who were disabled, you know, who were just disabled. I mean, it might not even have a genetic component. But also, interestingly, he included in his list epileptics. And what later became clear is that Harry Laughlin himself was epileptic yeah. and began to have a lot of seizures and couldn't drive a car. He never walked away from that idea. So, you know, his story does introduce this idea that, you know, how much of hatred and disapproval is really self-hatred and self-disapproval.
So is it, do you think that he knew he was epileptic and there was some self-loathing going on in him putting that category as defective?
You know, it's one of the great mysteries of yeah. the story. We don't know that. We do know that he and his wife never had children. And we also know that he was in a category epileptic that he thought should not have children. But we don't know exactly why he didn't have children. We do know, as I say, though, that while he was still very much in the game and he was still working as head of the Eugenics Record Office on Long Island, he was having seizures. He nearly drove his car into the ocean and was had to stop driving. And at no point, as I say, did he walk away from it. So he clearly was fine putting himself in this category even when he knew he was in the category.
How many defectives did Harry Laughlin figure there were in the country? Because he worked this out.
Yeah, he gave a famous speech to the Race Betterment Conference in Michigan, in Battle Creek, where he said 15 million people would have to go under the knife. And that makes sense because he had many, many, many categories that he and he thought as long as they were reproducing, and they had this theory of what they call differential fecundity, where they thought the feeble-minded had many more children. As long as these people were out there reproducing, there was no hope, he thought, of really uplifting the race. So it had to be, in his mind, a very aggressive program.
15 million sterilizations, he figured, in the end, they were going to have to carry out. And if you put it in the context of the American population of the time, that's a remarkable number.
It is, yeah, yeah, you know, somewhere 10-15%. But that was in keeping with their thinking. Yeah. And, you know, honestly, I'm sure that he would have liked to do more because these were people who, they were quite elitist. I mean, they really mm-hmm. felt that the, quote, best people were the best. I mean, you know, I'm sure he didn't feel he could suggest sterilizing 75 million people. But, you know, they really wanted, you know, the top to be the ones that reproduced. And there was this concept of negative eugenics and positive eugenics. Negative was things like sterilization, stopping the so-called unfit from reproducing. But positive was we really need to get the really good people, the people at the top, to reproduce more. So right. As I say, I mean, I think he was willing to settle for 15 million, but I think he really would have liked as many of the, you know, the lesser people, as he saw it, to be stopped from reproducing as he could possibly get.
It sounds like when you hear it now, it sounds like these were crackpots and they were on the fringe of society. But you mentioned people like Teddy Roosevelt and John Rockefeller and Alexander Graham Bell. Some really prominent Americans were not just supportive, but kind of gung-ho about the idea of eugenics.
That's right. And, you know, I recently wrote an article for my alumni magazine, for Harvard Magazine, about the fact that Harvard University was really in many ways the brain trust of this. So Harvard geneticists were writing books about in favor of eugenics. And the two really towering presidents of that era of Harvard University, President Eliot, who was emeritus by 1910, and President Lowell, they both supported eugenics. And President Eliot wrote an article, which I read, in which he called for eugenic sterilization. So, yes, this was not crackpots. This was not, you know, people who were unexposed to big ideas. This really came from the top of the intellectual firmament.
Columbia, Berkeley, trying to think. A lot of the print sort of prominent universities of the time had courses dealing with eugenics.
Absolutely. And the first president of Stanford was a very prominent eugenicist. The most prominent economist at Yale was a leader in the eugenics movement. And then, of course, as we know, when it gets to the Supreme Court, 8 of the 9 justices, and the great Oliver Wendell Holmes, who, mm-hmm. you know, for many people embodied really enlightened reason and, you know, good judgment. And his father had been the dean of Harvard Medical School, and you know, many people think that Sherlock Holmes was named after the senior Oliver Wendell Holmes because the father was such a rational man, as was the son. So these are people who really we would expect to get it right, to be thoughtful with the science and with the equities and the justice and all that. And look how wildly they were all wrong about it.
Eugenics, you say, offered two solutions for those who were worried about urbanization and immigration. One, you say, it dealt with the threat from without, which is to say these new immigration laws needed to be in place to limit unfit races from coming in. But then there was another, and we'll talk about that a little bit later in the program, but then there was this other solution dealing with the danger from within, and that meant potentially sterilizing, you know, millions of people. But there are two solutions here. I mean, this is a pretty discreet strategy that they have in mind for dealing with the immigrants flowing in, I suppose.
Yeah, that's right, because they really did sort of break it down that way. They thought there are all these terrible foreigners coming with their terrible genes, and then there are also all these terrible Americans who are already here. So they needed a different strategy for each. And these proceeded on two paths, and they were both moving at a pretty rapid clip at the same time. So we get the major immigration overhaul is the Immigration Act of 1924. Right. The major eugenics case is Buck versus Bell, 1927. So it was definitely an aggressive two-track system going on at the same time.
Adam Cohen is with us. His book is Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a period in America's history where there was a flourishing movement to try and purify America's bloodline. This was eugenics, the idea that if you kept certain races from coming into the country or if you sterilized the unfit already here, you could breed out the human defectives. And who was defective? The feeble-minded, whatever that means, people of color, the poor. The journalist Adam Cohen has written a book, and he builds his story around the case of Carrie Buck. His book is called Imbeciles, and he's joining us from NPR in New York to talk about it. So it's interesting that this critical Supreme Court case, Buck v. Bell, starts in Virginia, because as you point out, Virginia wasn't at all in the forefront of the sterilization movement. In fact, you say in some ways it was kind of the opposite of that.
Yeah, it was a little slow. The first eugenic sterilization law in the nation was passed by Indiana in 1907. So you might have thought it would be a state like Indiana or a few of the other early states. that prompted the Supreme Court case, but it was actually really because of one man who's one of the people I focus on in this book, a lawyer named Aubrey Strobe, who felt strongly that Virginia should not begin sterilizing people until the law that it enacted was upheld by the courts. He really felt all the way up to the Supreme Court. So he was very cautious. In other states, they passed a law, they just started sterilizing people. They didn't really care what the courts thought. But because of that attitude, which was really because of the advice of one man, Virginia moved very slowly. It insisted on getting court rulings first, and therefore became the state that produced this big test case.
Strode is an interesting character. He seemed really ambivalent about eugenics. In fact, once he wins the case, Buck v. Bell, you know, where he argues in front of the Supreme Court, he kind of lets it go, didn't really say much more about it after that.
Yeah, that's right. I became really fascinated by him, and in part that's, I think, because I had to go through 158 boxes of his papers, which were uncategorized at the University of Virginia. There was no finding aid of any kind, they told me apologetically. So I really felt I got to know a lot about his life and his very mundane law firm business correspondence. But also, he was in many ways a great progressive. His big cause as a young legislator was trying to extend education in Virginia to women and trying to get women to be admitted to the University of Virginia. He favored other really good progressive things like getting more roads built and things like that. And then of all the people involved in this eugenics crowd, he was the one who really didn't talk much in favor of it, didn't seem to support it. And he wrote a statute. He wrote the Virginia law in a way that actually minimized the number of categories that were eligible, that said we will only allow sterilizations if it can be shown that it's in the patient's interest. And then he required that the courts sign off on it. So I really found, you know, that he may have been ambivalent. There were things about him I liked. But in other ways, what he did was unforgivable, not only because he won the case in the Supreme Court, but also Carrie Buck was railroaded in this proceeding. Mm-hmm. She really didn't get a lawyer to represent her properly. There was a mockery of a trial. And he was there for all of that, and he permitted that. So I think ambivalence is the most I can really muster about Aubrey Strode.
It's true. There's such a conflicting view of a lot of characters. We'll get back to Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. Because his attitude and his writing is kind of despicable. But we'll come back to that. Let's talk about Carrie Buck. Because she's sort of when she comes into the picture, she's 17 years old. She's got this tomboy spirit, as you describe it. And she has come to live with this foster family, Alice and John Dobbs. Tell us about Carrie Buck.
Yeah, you know, we don't know so much about her, but the things we know about her and when we do hear her voice, she really sounds like quite a fine person who was in terrible circumstances. She was raised by a single mother, often on the streets of Charlottesville, gets taken in by this foster family. And the spirit then was that taking in poor children into middle class families was going to help them. So this was considered to be a great progressive thing. But this family was not very nice to her. She wasn't allowed to call the foster parents mother and father. She also was put to work pretty quickly, both housekeeping in that house and in other houses in the neighborhood. So she's really not treated well. And then when she is raped by a nephew of the foster family, this terribly traumatic, horrible thing happens to her, they decide, well, the right thing to do is to get her declared feeble-minded and epileptic, which she certainly was not. She never had a seizure in her life. And they succeed, and they get her shipped off to this Dickensian colony for epileptics and feeble-minded. So, you know, when she arrives in this case, you look at what she's gone through of just living on the streets and being abused by her foster family and being raped and then being shunted aside while she's pregnant, and you just feel, you know, that this is someone who really got a very poor lot in life.
Her story really mirrors her mother's in a lot of ways. Emma is also down on her luck, was determined to be lacking in moral sense and responsibility, as they put it, believed to be thin. She's put in that category of being feeble-minded. And what's interesting about this idea about feeble-mindedness is that it really, you say it focused, and you sort of mentioned this earlier, it often focused young women, and it meant that they had strong sex drives. What was that getting at? Just this fear of these permissive women? What was it about, do you think, that category?
I think it was, because when you think about all the ways in which our nation was changing at that time, and, you know, I mentioned the flappers before, mm-hmm. there really was this sense of women's liberation in the 20s, of women suddenly, you know, dressing up in slinky dresses and going to, you know, parties where champagne was poured. And the roles were changing. And you can definitely see part of the feeble-mindedness movement as an attempt to put women back in the, you know, box of mm-hmm. chastity that they were deemed to belong in. So, yes, I think that was one of the changes that this reform movement was trying to hold back.
So Emma and Carrie are both sent to this, here's the name, Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. The epileptic thing is so strange, but anyway. So what happens when they first go there? You mentioned that they're given this intelligence test.
Yes, they are. It's an incredibly bad test. It's a test that was never developed to be an intelligence test, and the questions are, to the modern sensibility, somewhat crazy. I looked at some of the questions that Carrie was asked. You know, the intelligence test includes things like, what do you do when a playmate hits you, which is, I think, an interesting discussion to have with a child, but I'm not sure it's an IQ question, mm-hmm. and other things like that. But from these very, you know, badly drawn and, you know, often irrelevant questions, they were able to determine to their mind that Emma was a low-grade moron and Carrie was a medium-level moron. And these were categories of feeble-mindedness. So that really meant that with that determination, that suddenly put Carrie, who was of reproductive age, in the category of people who could be sterilized. Mm.
Let's mention a few other names. Charles Davenport is an interesting character. He's the one who founds this so-called Eugenics Record Office, which is set up in New York, on Cold Spring Harbor in New York. Talk a little bit about the office here, because it's so interesting. They offer marriage counseling. And this is sort of the center for, I suppose, for the eugenics movement, at least in that part of the country.
Yeah, well, actually, yeah, and nationally, they really were the leaders. They were the leaders in academic research on eugenics, in training of people, and it was this weird mix of sort of progressive, idealistic, academic approach to the situation. So Davenport was someone who had a PhD in Harvard. He'd originally been a professor there of zoology. He was very interested in animal breeding first, and then sort of made the transition. And they were trying to develop scientific principles for eugenics, and they brought in trainees, often young women, college graduates, to learn the methods of eugenics. So in some ways, it seemed kind of progressive and, you know, noble. They were trying to build a science, but then other parts of it were just horrible. And you know, one detail is that Harry Laughlin, the guy who ran the office with Davenport, his wife was active in the theater community around Cold Spring Harbor when they were living there. And she wrote a little play about eugenics. And the characters, one of the things they learn at the end is that the Jewish peddler, who seems like he might be someone that some of the female young women would have a romantic interest in, was not a eugenic match. So there was really this undercurrent of incredible bigotry and elitism, and, you know, so it was an odd place.
For Davenport, you write, it all came down to germplasm. Let's talk about germplasm.
Yeah, you know, so he was a zoologist, mm-hmm. and the way he actually met Harry Laughlin was in correspondence. Laughlin was living in Missouri about animal breeding, which they yeah. both loved. And they were both really interested in this idea that just as you can breed racehorses and you can breed dogs, you know, you can breed human beings to, you know, be better. They didn't know exactly how it worked. As I mentioned, you know, some of the developments in genetics were fairly new, the findings of Gregor Mendel. Yeah, so their idea was that germplasm was this thing that, you know, we might think of it more like a gene now, but it was something that was passed on. And they also felt that there was a national sort of stock of germplasm, mm-hmm. and one of their goals was to uplift the entire national stock of germplasm in America and make it better by keeping out the bad foreign germplasm, getting rid of some of the Carrie Buck germplasm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what it was about for them.
How would you field test this? Because they, you know, they did a lot of research, and it seems so faulty, just the general idea. So how would you test these pseudoscientific ideas?
Well, their science was, you know, I think to our minds, rather laughable now, but, you know, they trained these young women, you know, sometimes graduates of the Seven Sisters schools, in such new skills as measuring the cranium, because they figured that the size of the cranium would correlate with the size of the brain. So there were different procedures for doing that. But they also would send people out to do what they called eugenics field work. And as I mentioned, a lot of these were trips to poor rural areas, and they would try to find families like the Jukeses that they thought were just genetically, frowned upon. And it would be things like they would interview the neighbors, and they'd say, John, who lives, down the road, did you know John's grandfather? And was he the sort of guy who got up early in the morning and went to work, or did he just lie around the house? That, and they would do elaborate questionnaires about this and family trees based on all kinds of rumor and conjecture. So pseudo is really the right kind of science to call it.
I'm not sure if it was Laughlin or Davenport or one of these guys who was able to convince the census office to give them census data that they tried to use for the eugenics idea.
Yeah, that was Laughlin. And, towards the end of Laughlin's life, he was really beginning to think much bigger. He was getting, data from the census office. He was also trying to create a federal office that would be in charge of eugenics programs. But unfortunately for him, just as he was really getting established in the field and becoming more influential, eugenics was in decline for a number of reasons. So he did get the genetic, he did get the census data, but some of his bolder visions of a really grand eugenic experiment really never came to fruition.
I wonder, how far does Laughlin or Davenport or any of the proponents of eugenics, how far do they really take it? At least the idea of euthanasia, for example. Mass sterilization, sure, that was considered, but did the idea of euthanasia, when does it enter the picture? How do they think about that part of cleaning up the American bloodline?
Yeah, well, Laughlin is part of a committee that actually looks at that at one point. And in the papers I read, it was very quickly dismissed because everyone agreed it would never happen, that it just, it wasn't viable. But it was the sort of reference which, made me think, wow, is this being abandoned because they think it's a bad idea, or is this being abandoned because they know that it has no chance of happening? And they definitely didn't have to reach the question of whether they would have wanted it because they knew it wouldn't happen. I think that they figured that, this sterilization was already controversial enough. It was about as far as they could reasonably go. And these were pragmatists. So someone like Harry Laughlin wasn't really sitting around writing novels about his ideal vision of a eugenic paradise. He was really thinking, what can I get through legislatures? And sterilization was kind of what they fixed on.
Mm-hmm. How many states signed on to this idea?
Yeah, about 30 or so. So a majority of, it depends how you count, because there were states that were passing laws and they were being vetoed by governors. They were being signed and then they were being struck down. But yeah, a majority of the states did. And, it's surprising that the number one state with the most sterilizations by far in the country was California. Yeah. Because we think of Virginia associated with the Buck versus Bell case, but it actually makes sense because, as I mentioned, eugenics was in many ways a progressive movement. It was an idea about taking science and embracing it and using it to build a better world. And California was, and in many ways still is, a real progressive, cutting edge part of the country. So it's not surprising that, 20,000 probably of the 60 to 70,000 sterilizations in the United States occurred in California.
Adam Cohen is with us. His book is Imbeciles: The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the journalist Adam Cohen. We're talking about his book, Imbeciles: The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. I wanted to ask you, I guess it goes without saying, because that the influence of the American eugenics had really its most powerful influence, I suppose, at least outside of the country, in Nazi Germany, fair to say?
Yes. And, you know, it is fascinating to think that we associate eugenic sterilization with the Nazi movement, as we should, because they did much more. They did probably 375,000 eugenic sterilizations. But we were way ahead of them, right? Indiana passed its sterilization law in 1907. Yeah. And there was a lot of correspondence between Harry Laughlin and the Nazi scientists who he admired and wanted to help about eugenics. And there's no question that they were following the American lead.
Well, it gets us to there's this really sad irony in that some of the Nazis who were tried in Nuremberg after the war, they end up invoking the American model generally and frankly, Oliver Wendell Holmes' ruling in particular.
Yeah. And, you know, in the classic movie Judgment at Nuremberg, there's a famous scene where Maximilian Schell, the actor who's playing the lead lawyer for the Nazis, reads from a case that he does not describe. And then he asks if any of the Americans can identify it. And he says, you know, this is from these are the words of your great Oliver Wendell Holmes. And, you know, your Supreme Court endorsed eugenic sterilization. How can you put my client on trial for it? And, you know, he had a bit of a point based on how terrible ruling Buck versus Bell was.
Mm. You mentioned how Harry Laughlin admired and supported Germany's racial cleansing policies and their sterilization policies. And we should also point out that he spoke out against, and others within the eugenics movement did too, but against allowing Jewish refugees of Nazi Germany being allowed in this country. That seems to have had a pretty devastating effect.
That's correct. And first, he had testified to Congress as his title was actually eugenics agent, expert eugenics agent. There was letterhead, which I saw saying expert eugenics agent, to the U.S. Immigration Committee. So he testifies to Congress and prods them to pass the initial law of 1924 that keeps out folks who will be fleeing Nazi Germany. And then, yes, as you say, when they're trying to flee, he actually is commissioned to write a report about whether the rule should be relaxed even temporarily, and he says no. So he was, yes, quite a consistently horrible figure in all of this.
Adolf Hitler, when he's writing Mein Kampf, becomes familiar with the writing of a man named Madison Grant, who's written this book called The Passing of the Great Race, refers to it as Hitler refers to this as my Bible. Where does Madison Grant fit in this?
Yeah, he's a eugenics popularizer, and there were a couple of them who were writing these best-selling books that were about, you know, the threat to the white race. And, you know, one of the great novels of this time, the 1920s, is The Great Gatsby. And there's a scene in it where Tom Buchanan, who is Daisy Buchanan's husband, is sort of ranting at a luncheon, and he says, I'm reading this book about how, you know, the colored races are rising up around the world and, you know, we're in danger. And he gives the name of an author that's a little bit like Madison Grant, a little bit like this other guy, Stoddard, who wrote another of these popular eugenics books. So these books were really, yes, it's said that Hitler regarded that as his Bible, but they definitely were having a big impact on popular opinion, enlightened popular opinion in the United States as well.
Well, you mentioned it was it permeated popular culture, that you referred to books, and there are these conferences and these traveling lectures. They'd visit these civic clubs around the country. It was an intellectual craze. You even mentioned, which I thought intriguingly, at least one horror film.
There was a horror film?
Yeah, I wondered about that.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a horror film in which a doctor, you know, doesn't do the right thing and abort the, you know, unfit fetus, and it comes back to, you know, to kill him. Yes, it really was everywhere. And, you know, for me, just a little local thing is, as a child, I always used to go to the National Museum of Natural History here in New York, which is a wonderful place. It has an amazing planetarium. And I was sort of shocked to realize that it was the host of the second International Eugenics Congress, which was a terrible operation. And there were people from around the world who, you know, spouted all these racist theories. There were exhibits in the exhibit hall with the different inferior races. And as far as I know, the museum has never really even, you know, admitted its role in that. I mean, that's one thing about this, is that so much of the nation was implicated in it because these were very popular movements. And I don't think we've really analyzed them enough.
Did Carrie Buck ever have much of a chance before the court? What was the strength of her case?
Yeah, I mean, she should have had more of a chance. Yeah. But, you know, she herself was uneducated because she had been pulled out of school by her horrible foster family. She was given a lawyer who was not on her side. He'd actually been the chairman of the board of the Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. So he was, you know, pretty clearly trying to get her sterilized. And the main place where she really needed to put up a big fight was at the trial, where they should have put on strong evidence that she wasn't epileptic at all. She'd never had a seizure. She wasn't feeble-minded. Mm. She was doing well in school. There were grades showing she was doing just fine. Her teachers could have said that she was doing fine. Everyone who ever knew her as an adult said there was nothing wrong with her. So, except her lawyer didn't want to do that. So that the fact pattern was really terrible. I do think, even with all that, when it got to the Supreme Court, people like Holmes could have realized what was going on. It had been widely written about at that point that these intelligence tests were were garbage. And also the court was at that moment developing a theory of liberty that it was applying in other cases, a constitutional right to liberty that included the right to raise children. Yeah. If they had been enlightened and approached the case correctly, they could have said that what was being taken away from Carrie was something that was very fundamental. But the problem was that Holmes in particular, but also some of the other members of the court, they really believed in eugenics. They were waiting for this case to come along. So in that sense, she didn't have a chance because the people on the court were not inclined to give her one.
Oliver Wendell Holmes was he wrote – this is interesting. He wrote that opinion in 1927. He was 86 years old, still pretty lucid at that point and really proud of his opinion.
Yeah, he was kind of a cynical fellow in many ways. He had been through the Civil War as a young man, wounded three times, nearly killed, watched some of his close friends be killed. And he was kind of cynical in general, wasn't a supporter of a lot of the progressive causes of his time. It's interesting that he really did like eugenics, and he did write in correspondence that this was one of the few opinions he wrote in his career that really gave him pleasure. Yeah. Yes, this was something that excited him.
So what happens after Buck v. Bell? The sterilization movement seemed to be faltering, but it kind of breathes new life into the movement.
Absolutely. And the next year, 1928, Mississippi passes a eugenic sterilization law, and the rate of sterilization increases. It had been faltering a bit, but suddenly the U.S. Supreme Court, such an important moral force in our country, gives it a major imprimatur where they not only upheld the Virginia law, but they said, we need to do more of this. We need to stop, the country from being, drowned in this tide of imbecility. So, yes, there's more sterilizations and, many tens of thousands of people were sterilized after 1927 who wouldn't have been if the court had come out the other way.
One of the questions that comes from a listener in Bountiful, a man named Jonathan, he wants to know the Catholic Church's role in all of this. And you write about that. The Catholic Church plays kind of an important role in opposing these sterilizations.
Absolutely. I have said that if there's one hero in this story, and it's a story with very few heroes, it is the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. The Pope had not yet issued his formal encyclical against eugenics, but many, many Catholics and Catholic leaders were opposed to eugenics, both because of the traditional church reverence for reproduction, but also because of the Catholic view that people should be judged by their inner souls, by their inner worth, not by these, physical qualities that the eugenicists were so focused on. So when bills were put up in legislatures, the one group that turned out fairly predictably were Catholics, nuns, priests, Catholic lay people. And in states like Louisiana with a high Catholic population, they didn't pass eugenic sterilization laws. And that was because of the church. So yes, if anyone gets any credit for, what happened in the story, I would say it is the Catholic Church and lay people.
Opposition starts to grow. And I love the story that you tell from Kentucky's state legislature. One lawmaker taking a shot at eugenics. He said, here's the quote. He said, if the bill had been enacted in an earlier generation, there would not be so many fools in the legislature now.
Exactly. And, that does get at a slight, popular discomfort with it. And in many ways, this was an elitist movement, right? I mean, it's one thing for folks in Harvard to say, yeah, let's only let the most, high IQ people reproduce. But I think a lot of ordinary Americans realize, this was aimed at them. This was a lot of pointy-headed people saying that there was something wrong with them. So you do get this kind of, popular uprising, as there should have been.
And it's interesting that laws sort of modeled after the American eugenics movement, they really take off in other countries. Denmark and Sweden and Norway and Finland and Iceland, these northern European countries that wouldn't have been excluded from coming into the United States, they felt like they could pass these laws too in their countries, I suppose.
That's correct. And when an American researcher traveled through Europe, and she found that they were really modeling themselves, not surprisingly, on the United States. And one thing, though, that happened is when Nazi Germany embraced it and really turned eugenics into a movement closely associated with Nazism and the idea of a master race, you began to see enthusiasm flag worldwide for it.
It doesn't really fall apart completely in eugenics until the 1960s, which seems surprising. And you also mentioned, really, Buck v. Bell has never been overturned. In fact, it's still cited as case law.
Yeah, both correct. You might think that with the defeat of Nazi Germany that we would have said, okay, these were Nazi ideas, they're not American ideas. But actually, after World War II, there's pretty steady sterilization, and it does really go in significant numbers through the 60s and 70s. It was really the 60s rights revolution and the idea that, you know, marginalized people maybe deserve more rights that kind of undercut it. And yeah, it has not been overruled. And as recently as 2001, a U.S. Court of Appeals in Missouri, so that's just one step below the Supreme Court, cited Buck versus Bell as good law in a case involving sterilization of a mildly retarded woman. So, yeah, the court has had opportunities to overturn this over the years, and it has chosen to keep Buck versus Bell.
I guess it's fair to say we've put aside for the most part the idea of eugenics. But with the biology of genomic research, I wonder if the modern version of these questions are going to come up again. I mean, Could we fix a faulty genetic code? Could we strip out certain characteristics like Down syndrome or alcoholism? And what if there's a, you know, so-called gay gene? I mean, this seems like a kind of modern question now.
Yes, absolutely. And this idea of editing the human embryo has led to the concept of so-called designer babies.
Yeah.
But then just the other day, the New York Times had this incredibly intriguing story saying that there was just a conference recently at Harvard, which was the center of the last eugenics movement, looking into the idea of could we build a person from scratch by manufacturing all of their DNA? Mm. And, I sent out a tweet about that saying, is this eugenics 2.0? But when you think about it, it's one thing to edit existing DNA, but what if we actually just start building people?
Yeah.
And what will we build them like? So I think that the 21st century is going to raise so many issues of eugenics and how we should respond to them. And the idea that Buck versus Bell is still kicking around is kind of scary because there's going to be a lot more for us to chew over.
I wanted to quickly go back to something we were talking about earlier about this code of Hammurabi, the idea that the strong and powerful should protect the weak. In the end of the book, you write about Darwin, who said, yes, you know, natural selection allows the, you know, it's about the survival of the fittest, but we have to allow the weak to survive. I just wonder, will we always struggle with this, do you think, Adam Cohen? You know, are we naturally inclined to kind of root for the fittest? And will this always be kind of a struggle for us as a species?
I think it will, but I think both of these are very much part of humanity. There is this, you know, I think bullying and this, you know, elitism and this attempt to, you know, oppress the weak. But there also is a sense of justice. And that's what Darwin's getting at, too, and saying that it was such an important part of humanity that we can't let it go. So I think it will always be a struggle. But I do think that even though the court got it wrong in 1927, that there are a lot of people that are rooting for the just result and trying to protect the weak. So I don't think we should give up yet.
Adam Cohen, his book is Imbeciles, The Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. Thanks very much for the time.
My pleasure.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.